Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
You're very welcome back. 51551, that is our text. Now, Ben Cain, welcome to studio. Author Ben Cain is here. Sunday Times bestselling author. Written lots of books on the Roman Empire and so on, haven't you? Yeah. How many books have you written, by the way?
My 19th is Stormcrow. So.
This is 19th?
Yeah.
Wow, congratulations. Yeah. And they've been translated and everything. And
yeah, 15 languages.
Only 15. And including fluent Dundalk.
Including from the town, hey.
From the town. And how many of those 19 novels have you set in Ireland?
So one of my books about Richard the Lionheart has a central character from Carlingford, but there isn't anything about Carlingford because he's a hostage in Wales. So
yeah,
this book, Stormcrow, is the first one actually set in Ireland. It's taken me this long.
That's extraordinary. And so why did you set this one in Ireland? How did you wait so long?
I'd wanted to write about the Vikings or the Romans when I started out, and yeah. Bernard Cornwell's first Uhtred novel, everybody knows the Last Kingdom on TV, his first novel about that was in the shops, and I thought that meant I couldn't write about the Vikings.
Okay.
And I stood there cursing him outside of Waterstones in England and said, right, it has to be the Romans.
So you were burning to write about the Vikings
at
the start
of your writing
career.
Yeah, I was.
But the Romans, it was also a good decision.
Well, I read Asterix when I was a kid and I was hugely into history, and there was a book called The Eagle of the Ninth about the Romans that I loved. And I mean, history was my favourite subject apart from, you know, animals, because I became a vet. And it was a toss-up between the Romans and the Vikings, and it's taken me 19 books, but finally I got to them.
That's extraordinary. And you've done some job, because there are things about the Vikings I didn't know. We think we know them here, but sometimes maybe the familiarity means we don't look at them as closely as we do. But you're back home now, and this story is very close to home, isn't it? Although you weren't born in Ireland, is that right?
No, I was born in Kenya, but my dad, when we came back to Ireland when I was young, and my dad is a vet, he was working for the department, and he ran the meat factory in Ravensdale. So we lived in Castle Bellingham, and I went to school in Dundalk, and then I went to university in Dublin. But I sort of grew up from a small child till when I finished school in Castle Bellingham.
And what was he doing out in Africa? Was he a vet there?
A vet there, yeah. Okay. Yeah, disease control, basically. Things like foot and mouth and other horrible diseases.
What age were you when you left?
Six.
Six, but you would have memories then.
Yeah, yeah. I went back. I worked for a summer in Africa when I was in vet school, and I went to where we used to live, and I found our house, having not seen it from the age of 6 to 21. I found it in 10 minutes.
Was that moment like?
It was funny because there was maize growing where my mum's roses used to be in the flower beds, and there were goats on the lawn. But yeah, it was cool. I didn't knock on the door. I felt a bit embarrassed, but it was nice. Yeah,
I presume that would have had a great impact on your life. You know, you're up to 6 years of age. Living in Africa.
Yeah, I mean, I used to annoy all my classmates. I can remember because I used to say like I'd been on safari and seen lions, and they didn't believe me. So I used to get the mick taken out of me quite a lot.
But it was true.
But it was true. I mean, I was probably quite, you know, quite outspoken, but I still am. But yeah, it did have a big impact on me. Huge, yeah.
Why is that? Were you a bit of a brat in school?
I had an English accent in Dundalk in 1977.
Oh, dear.
So I used to get called Brit.
Did you though?
I did, yeah.
Did that affect you?
Well, if any of the teachers are listening, I got away with it because I was bright, but I fought my way through primary school. Luckily, because I was bright, if I'd been bad at school, I might have had a different life. But
yeah.
Had to learn Irish, having not done it for the first few years. So I found that very difficult.
Yes.
It took me to my Leaving Cert. I got a B in my Leaving Cert, but I really struggled with Irish until literally the end of school.
Understandably.
Yeah, yeah. So.
With wasn't much sympathy around in talk.
No. It was what it was. It was the 1980s. You know, as people know, it was a different town to what it is now.
And is Castle Bellingham was home.
Bellingham, hey, yeah.
it's a little village down south out of Dundalk.
That's right, 9 miles. It's got a castle, and lovely river. The castle is a big place for weddings nowadays. It's much bigger than it used to be. And it was 300 people when I was growing up, but there must be close on 1,000 now, I'd reckon.
Yeah.
So, and there's this little village a little bit further on called Annagassan. And when I was a child, there was sort of word that the Vikings might have been there, but nobody had a clue that there had actually been a settlement there. And it wasn't until 2005 and then a couple of other occasions, a local historian called Micheál McKeown, who used to work for Carroll's, and he's a sculptor, an incredible man, really. And yeah. he got interested in it and together with a couple of archaeologists, Ned Kelly was one of them. They worked out that because of the angle of the River Glyde, where it comes out at Annagassan,
yeah.
it's like a fish hook, the way it comes out to the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And the Vikings used to like safety. Three sides water, one side you put a wall. So
right.
if you can imagine you're inside the fish hook.
Perfect conditions.
And you put a rampart across the top where the hook meets the body of the hook. Then you've got a very safe place. And literally the very first time they used ground radar, they found evidence of the Vikings.
That's cool. Oh, after instantly. All that time?
Yeah. Well, he'd found by walking the fields, he'd found lots of Viking objects that had been dredged out of the river, because the river used to be dredged about every 50 years.
Okay.
So you can walk along and literally on the surface of the fields find Viking combs, Viking nails.
Really?
So he was very suspicious. But then when they did the ground radar, they literally, you know, went.
Definitely was a settlement.
Yeah, as big as Viking Dublin. Yeah.
In Annagassan, hey?
In Annagassan, and still unexcavated, sadly.
Right. Well, yeah. maybe something's going to happen there.
Maybe. It's sort of, he was telling me, he sadly, very sadly died last autumn, so I never got to meet him, but I spoke to him and he gave me a huge amount of information about the archaeological finds and so on. And the Norwegian ambassador in 2019 came up to visit and he gave her a Viking sword and she was hugely interested and was talking about €100,000 donation to help the investigations. And then COVID hit and she was moved to a new job and away, you know. It's typical of archaeological sites, though,
yeah.
you know, because they're very expensive to dig. And, you know, in the world we live in, there's money is needed in other places for roads and hospitals and everything. People go, why would you spend €5 million digging up something? You know, but people who are interested in history, well,
we want to know. We want to know the past.
Yeah.
I'll come back to your own story in a minute. But since we're on the Vikings now, because this is where Stormcrow is very much set, isn't it? This is the mm-hmm. universe we're going in, and particularly the Vikings in Ireland. Tell us who Finn is at the centre of this story.
So I wanted, my books are always set in the past. They usually involve conflict, lots of it. And but it's always good to try and make your character as multifaceted as possible.
Yeah.
So I made this young lad half Irish, half Norse, because so he'd have divided loyalties. And in the late 10th century, Ireland was predominantly Christian. So even the Vikings who lived there, the Norse who lived there, were mostly Christian, but there would have still been some pagans.
Mm-hmm.
So I have him as a pagan and he has a friend who's a shaman. And he finds a sword on Annagassan strand and his life's changed when his father's murdered and he seeks revenge. And he ends up going to places like Monaster Boyce and Nowth and goes through Slane all the way over to Loch Ennell in Westmeath, which is where the High King of Ireland used to live. And of course, Viking Dublin is in it and Waterford and Clonmacnoise and so on. Sort of did a Viking tour of Ireland.
You really did, yeah. Well, I love it because most of your readers, they are British, aren't they? It's Sunday Times bestseller.
The majority, yeah.
Yeah, so it's lovely to have that. But we obviously want people to pick this up here in Ireland to realise this is a story of our own. And it's we think we know about the Vikings, don't we? But we don't.
Well, I have to say I learned a lot about them myself.
You
we always have perceptions of whatever period of history, often influenced by TV and film and maybe some books we've read. And frequently there are errors that are continued to be told. You know, the horned helmets.
Obviously,
the Vikings never wore horned helmets. But I actually put a note at the front of the book because I wanted people to realise that I wasn't making stuff up. So there's a Viking academic called Professor Neil Price. He's probably one of the world's leading Viking archaeologists. He's professor of history in Uppsala in Sweden. And I've read a few of his books and I contacted him and he was generous enough to read the book and to tell me what he thought. And he basically gave it the thumbs up. So I've got the shaman, the people who practiced magic in the Viking world were generally women. But if they weren't women, they were gay and they were really looked down on. There are lots of derogatory words in Norse about them, but people would have been terrified of them as well.
And it's the Norse that are essentially homophobic towards them, isn't it?
But interestingly, the Irish were not. So this was great when I found that out.
And so how do we know that?
It's scant evidence, but there is some documentation of Irish kings with male companions for quite a long time.
Really?
And no bad comment about it. So
I wonder why we didn't discuss this in history, perhaps.
Fintan O'Toole would say it's the knowing unknowing.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, don't acknowledge what we know.
Yeah, so there's very little survives in the form of text from early Irish civilizations because all they had was Ogham. It wasn't until the monks started writing things down. But what we've got, which is you know, you have to use what you've got, and what you haven't got, you know, you can't say, well, it definitely happened if you can't prove it. But from the little we have, it seems that certainly in Irish nobility that being gay was all right. So I took that and ran with it. So the Irish don't really mind, but this shaman who's gay, the Vikings, well, they don't like him, but they're also scared of him. So yeah.
It's interesting that they found a role in society for someone who a fella who might have been a bit feminine.
Well, they will have had a role all through history. It's just we don't know about it.
Of course, So Finn's best friend.
His best friend, Vekkel, is this shaman. And then I brought in a find, or used the find from a place in Sweden called Birka, which was, funnily enough, a find from the 1930s. And it was a warrior grave with spears, swords, axe, blah-de-blah, horse gear and all that. And the male archaeologist didn't bother looking at the skeleton and said it was a man. And in 2017, a female archaeologist pulled the drawer out in the cupboard of the, you know, they literally have hundreds of these in these big museums that aren't on show. And she examined the pelvis. I don't know why, but she did. And as your listeners probably know, the pelvis of a woman is very different to the pelvis of a man.
Yeah.
So she went, this is a woman. And suddenly you had a woman who'd been buried with the accoutrements of a warrior. And it's the first time it's ever been proven. And it created the most incredible storm. I mean, she was threatened and people were saying she was lying and making it up. And she'd changed the bones around.
Just because she checked?
Just because
Something we could have known 100 years ago.
Yeah, and she was challenging what we think. Now, nobody knows. So you get endless speculation in the TV series Vikings. You've got loads of women warriors and so on. You can't say that because we don't know anything about the woman. But what we can say is she was a woman and she was buried with that. And all the other graves that are male and buried with weapons, they were warriors. So she had some kind of warrior role.
She was
definitely
a prominent figure.
Yes, yes.
Or else they wouldn't have buried her like that.
Yeah. And so what I did was I looked at, there are multiple examples, like dozens and even more, from the American Civil War of women who dressed up as a man and went to war, following their husband, getting away from an abusive husband, maybe just wanted adventure, and maybe they were transgender. And there are examples from the Royal Navy. There was a British Army surgeon in the 19th century who was a woman and they didn't know it until she died, and so on and so on. So I've got a warrior who is a woman, but if you call her a woman, she'll chop your head off. You know, I just thought, I was trying to make my book more interesting because, you know, when you write, well, nearly 20 books, they do become a little bit formulaic. So it's nice to have...
No, you're self-critiquing yourself. But it's good to have something new in it, isn't it?
Yeah.
And get you thinking about the world because writing about history really is a reflection of what we do today, isn't it, in many ways?
They're just
when
huge
similarities.
When you
have a fun swashbuckling yarn here and you nearly couldn't spoil the story because so much happens in it. But needless to say, there's a good bit of violence.
Indeed. That's what a lot of my readers want. I sort of don't write as much violence as I used to because, you know, it does become a bit repetitive and but it is fun. It wouldn't be fun if you're on the receiving end of a Viking axe, but there's a lot of fighting in it, but there are a lot of historical characters like Sitric Silkbeard and Brian Boru and the High King of Ireland, who's called Maile Sechnaill, and his daughter, who the hero meets. And so what I do with my books is I follow historical timelines very closely. I won't diverge from them if I can help it at all. And I have real people then, but fictional people to do the things that I need to make the story work, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's great fun.
I mean, the Vikings, they have had a significant impact on this country, even right up to this day. Yeah. Right to where our cities and our urban areas are, basically.
Yeah, certainly the Dublin and Waterford, Wexford, Carlingford, the name, even though it's not a true fjord because the sides aren't steep enough.
Oh, is that right? Oh,
but,
yes, okay.
But it's close to it. yeah, they did. And what I found fascinating about the research was how quickly the Vikings were assimilated. Hmm. So they came in the sort of early 800s, and by the late 900s, when this book is set...
They used to just raid the country.
Yeah, and they would settle. So for the Battle of Clontarf, there were Norsemen on both sides.
Yeah, it does get confusing, doesn't
it? Yeah. And there would have been Norse, Hiberno-Norse fighting what they would have called Vikings.
Because we like to say Brian Boru led the Irish, we defeated the Vikings.
It's nonsense.
End of.
Yeah, no. But, you know, what's interesting is that of all the recorded battles between the Irish and the Vikings over 200 years, the Irish won more of them.
So right, really?
They won about 55-60% of the battles that are recorded. So, you know, they weren't too shabby in a fight.
No, Brian Boru, of course, he dies. It's the most Irish win ever.
Yeah, killed by men fleeing the battle. Yeah,
glorious draw. Yeah. Almost, wasn't it?
But yeah, they won somewhat.
were Vikings going around your head when you were growing up in Castle Bellingham around Dundalk and that? Were you looking for a Viking spot?
Well, we used to go and visit the Round Tower in Monaster Boyce. Mm. So that was built after a brutal Viking raid. In fact, there were almost no monasteries left in County Louth by the late 900s because the Vikings had taken them all out.
Right.
They used to sail up the rivers, as people know. And the monastery never used that Round Tower because the Vikings didn't raid after that. But back in the day, you could knock on the door of the house beside it and get the key and go up to the top. So I always used to think of Vikings when we were there. There was a great series of books by a man called Henry Treese, which are kids' books, are still available. Now, they weren't in Ireland because there were almost no books about the Vikings in Ireland, but I certainly was quite interested in them.
Yeah, we already have a text in here from someone saying, delighted to be listening to a fellow Inneskeen man talking to Ben Kane. I spent years in the same history class as Ben with our teacher, Mr. McGeough, swapping stories. Heard all about the Anna Gass and Vikings over the years. Wishing Ben all the best. That's from Aidan.
Oh, nice.
That would
be Aidan Lawless. He was in my class.
It was in the Maris.
Or Aidan Carney. Aidan Carney's from Inneskeen.
Oh, right.
It's Aidan Carney. Hi, Aidan.
And that was the Maris.
And Mr. McGeough, whose nickname was Jazz, he was fantastic. He didn't teach us the Vikings, but he was one of our best teachers. He used to stalk up and down. He wore a linen jacket, and he'd be waving his chalk like this. And he certainly helped my love of history.
Lovely.
I sent him a book last year.
Oh, very good.
Via the school. He's retired, but hopefully he got it.
Yeah.
So just to say thank you.
Why was he called Jazz, do you remember?
I don't know.
Cool, was he?
I can't remember.
Great nickname.
Do you know what's weird is my kids now, like they're 17 and 15 in England, none of their teachers have nicknames. And I'm going, why don't they have nicknames? And they don't have an answer.
surely someone will mention the Anna Gasson war cry. Ask, says Ted in Cork.
Oh.
Do you understand what that is?
No.
Ted in Cork, let us know. What does he mean by the Anna Gasson war cry?
I don't know what that is.
That can be sarcastic now, make for the Northeast. Hey. Come here, you had a very interesting path to becoming a writer. So you mentioned you studied to be a vet. You had to leave Ireland to do that, did you?
No, I went to UCD.
Oh, you went to UCD.
Yeah, I went to UCD. Qualified in 92. Worked in Fermanagh for the first year.
Oh, right.
I did my interview and the sun was shining. I thought it was the most beautiful county in Ireland. And then I went
it
up
is.
And it rained every single day of the year.
But it looks nice in the rain.
It was lovely.
Mist between the trees, sorry.
Then I worked for 2 years in Drogheda for Westgate Vets. That was great. And then I worked in Armagh for a year. And then I went to England because of a girl and did Small Animal. And then I headed off. I did 3 years backpacking in the late 90s.
Dude, that sounds like that relationship didn't work out.
Now, she went with me for some of it.
Oh, did you? Okay,
but we split up when we got to Fiji. Or Samoa.
I'm laughing about it anyway.
Came back in 2001 and did foot and mouth disease, volunteered for that up in Northumberland.
Volunteered for that?
Because I'd seen foot and mouth when I was a vet student and I was kind of a large animal vet. And I did that for a year.
That was 2001. Imagine that. That feels much more recent.
I know.
People remember it was obviously Ireland shut down. And
that's very right.
We didn't have we cancelled our Patrick's Day parade and everything. Foot
and
mouth math. Mats everywhere. But in England, it was quite traumatic, wasn't it, for farmers?
It was. It was £5 billion and several million farm animals had to be killed.
Yeah. 6 million cows and sheep and lambs.
And that's what I was doing for a lot of it. So it was.
What do you mean? What you were doing?
I was supervising the killing.
Right.
Six, 7 days a week.
Did you have to do any of it yourself?
Yeah, I had to kill the lambs myself. Vets had to kill the lambs. So, yeah, it was. I actually got PTS from it.
How did you...
You have to inject them in the heart. So you have to have somebody hold them.
Yeah.
A soldier, usually, because they had soldiers helping us.
Really?
Yeah, and you have to feel the heart and give them an injection. It's brutal.
The poor little lambs.
It was horrific. There's no other way of saying it. But, unfortunately, it was a real example of politicians not listening to the veterinary advisors. When you get foot and mouth, you shut down animal movement immediately. Mm-hmm. And Tony Blair didn't do it for 4 days. And by 4 days, it had gone from 10 farms to 50. And that means it's out of control.
Right.
And it's like COVID. That's how it spreads. It's quickly. And so it was completely out of control when they started doing something, which is why it ended up taking so many animals to be killed.
So you said did you literally end up with post-traumatic stress
disorder? Yeah, not PTSD, because that's permanent, but PTS. So for some years afterwards, yeah. Yeah, and there's one of my mates from that time, and every time I see him, when we see each other, we literally well up with tears just from those memories.
Because the volume was so enormous.
Yeah, 35,000 animals I supervised the killing of.
Good Lord, what did that do to you?
Well, like I say, other than the PTS, we went out and drank. I mean, we painted the town red every single night.
In misery, yeah.
Yeah, and I kept in touch with a few of the farmers that I, for years and years afterwards, and there was one of them, I went to see them about 5 or 10 years ago, and they said to me, "You were very, very hungover the day you came out to take out our farm. You were obviously hanging." And I just looked at them and I said, "Was it really obvious?" And they said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, why didn't you do anything? Why didn't you complain?" And they said, "Because you did such a professional job."
Oh, wow.
And I just looked at them and went, "Okay, well, I'm glad. I'm sorry I was hungover, but we were doing that to cope." And yeah. And they said, the husband and wife said, "Oh, we reckoned that, so..." Yeah.
He understood then, I presume. Yeah, it would have been traumatic for farmers.
It was horrendous. There was one farmer I was on where he was in pieces. He broke down sobbing on my arm, on my shoulder, within a couple of minutes when I told him it was foot and mouth, because he'd isolated himself on his farm for 6 months. He'd gone for a haircut once in 6 months. I noticed there was a shotgun in the front porch. And I rang into the office and I said, "I need cops to come out and take away his gun. And I need another vet to do the cull, because I need to stay in the house with this man because I'm really worried about him."
Wow.
And they sent out an armed response unit, and they were all really gung-ho and they thought there was a situation. But the guys on the front gate with the disinfectant wouldn't let them in. It was hilarious.
Of course.
So yes. I had this lock, stock and two smoking barrels, only moment of my career, where I came out, walking out of the farm with a shotgun over one shoulder and an air rifle over the other, and handed them in a box of cartridges to these armed cops. And they're going, "Do we need to come in? Do we need to come in?" And I'm going, no, there are the two guns. There's all the ammunition. You can go away now.
It really sounds like that's a period I don't think people fully understand, certainly over in Britain, because it was so rural and away from, all the business.
It was a weird, weird time. It really was. You know,
this ended your veterinary career, essentially.
No, I went into small animal for 3 years after that, bought a house, sort of thought about my partnership.
So small animal pets and all that.
Pets, dogs and cats. Yeah, big interest was small animal surgery. But I'd started writing by then, and then I moved to Bristol to get a sort of work a 4 day week with no on call so I could write. Yeah. And then I wrote a novel, and then I got an agent. But as he said, all they do is Bloody March in this first book. Right. Write another one.
It was your Roman.
Yeah, it was Roman a Roman agents. One, and there was a lot of marching on Hadrian's Wall, which is where I'd worked.
Well, that was interesting, because Hadrian's Wall is what you could see when you're in
Northumberland. So I visited loads of the sites.
During the foot and mouth.
Yes. And that's really sparked my imagination.
Isn't that something else? You have two great loves kind of tugging at each other.
Yeah.
Do you miss being a vet?
When I see my friends who are still vets, I might go around in the car, and I like the smell of the disinfectant still. And it's nice to stand there in my wellies and not have to do the jobs, but not really, no. No. I wouldn't enjoy getting up at 4 a.m. to calve a cow now. I used to enjoy it. That was my favourite job, was calving cows.
It's a passion job.
It is, and it's very tough on you physically, especially if you're a large animal vet. It is
stressful.
Being a farmer.
Hugely stressful, yeah. So yeah, birthing the animal is nice, obviously.
It's the nice side of it, yeah.
The other side, not so much.
That's right.
So the Roman Empire came calling. Actually, you'll know that, because last September, it was a Swedish influencer that started this. She came out to her Instagram followers and said, ask your male partners and friends, the fellas in your life, how often they thought about the Roman Empire. And it turned out that a lot of people think about the Roman Empire almost every day. Yeah. And this debate went global and the phrase, you know, men can't stop thinking about the Roman Empire.
I didn't know it was the Swedish person. That's,
yeah, that's where it started. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Why do men think of the Roman Empire, Ben Kane?
Oh, look, I've been thinking about the Roman Empire. Well, I say it's so funny because in England, they generally write books about the Roman Empire. I'm Irish, obviously. So I write books about the Roman Republic when they didn't have an empire.
Oh, right.
Yes. I'm not particularly fond of monarchs.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
But I think about the Roman Empire or Republic every day because
centered
it's
where they
so
are,
incredible. Yeah. I mean, they lasted for 1,000 years. If you look at the Eastern Roman Empire in Constantinople, today Istanbul, that their language influenced French, Spanish and Portuguese and Italian. And the legal system is the basis of the Western legal system.
Yeah.
They also, one of the things I didn't ever expect to come out with, but having written all these books about war and having kids and thinking how horrible it would be if they were to fight in a war, peace is a very precious thing. And what the Romans did was they brought the Pax Romana, the Roman peace, to Western Europe for 200 years.
Right. Ironically, because they were so brutal.
But once they'd come in and you paid your tax and you said the emperor's a god, if you lived in France or Belgium or Spain or Portugal or Italy or Southern Britain, you had generation upon generation living and dying in peace, which is quite rare.
It's amazing. You're so into it. You actually do tours and everything. You go over to Rome and there are ones available. I'm Spartacus, that Campania, I presume, and Rome tours. There are tours you're actually doing this year.
That's right. So a company called Hidden History, I'm taking Uber fans and fans of mine on the sites from some of my books. I'm doing it in Germany next year.
Wow.
I also work as a bike guide doing historical tours where I talk the history as well as cycling big distances. That's a company called Ride and Seek. If people like riding
Ride and Seek and Hidden History. Do you get to do the outdoors, which is the veterinary stuff? But in the meantime, men should think about Vikings as much as they can. Stormcrow is the name of the new novel. You're doing the hometown tonight because you're based, you live in England now.
I live in Somerset.
Somerset's a beautiful part of the world.
Part, yeah. But I come home to see my mum and dad are still in Castle Bellingham.
So River Row books tonight.
In Cambrasas Street. It's booked out, but I believe we can squeeze a few more in if people want to chance their arm. They'd be very welcome.
Tonight, 7 o'clock Street. They've moved actually to a more prominent location.
Yeah.
Fair play. But Ben Kane, thanks so much for coming in to us.
That's great.
51551 is the text. There's lovely messages coming in for Ben Kane, but we've run out of time. Stormcrow is the novel. Do get it. Great, rollicking story about the Vikings in Ireland. He's in Row River Books, Clanblassel Street, 7 o'clock tonight in Dundalk. Claire Byrne is next. We'll chat to you again tomorrow. Slán.
0818 715 925. Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.